This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Today is Veterans Day, and we'll visit the experience of American servicemen and women in Iraq by listening back to interviews with three veterans of the Iraq War and an award-winning journalist who's covered the fighting. John Crawford was stationed in Iraq as a member of Florida's National Guard. He fought during the invasion and during the occupation patrolled the streets of Baghdad. While he was there, he started writing stories. A reporter embedded with his unit for a day, Christian Parenti, read one of his stories, liked it, and helped him find an agent. Now Crawford has a war memoir called The Last True Story I'll Ever Tell. Terry Gross spoke to him in August.
One of the things you talk about in your book is your gear. You complain about everything from your vehicles to your guns, your shoes. Would you describe some of the problems you had?
Well, actually, we didn't even go over there with vehicles. We ended up getting vehicles from the 3rd Infantry Division, and when they left, we didn't have any. And we just, you know, you beg, borrow, and steal. At one point, my squad had an SUV we had knocked the doors out of. We'd taken it from a guy who threatened us with a bomb. We knocked the doors off of it and mounted a machine gun on the back, and we drove that around and painted Alibaba on the side. That's was the Arabic term for a thief. And that was what we drove around. We were wearing Vietnam-era flak vests. We actually carried M16A1s, and there was a little scratch mark, and there was a 2 written there. And, you know, that the rifles were over 2 decades old. All our equipment was Vietnam era, except for our night vision. But the night vision we got, we didn't have enough swing arms to mount them, so nobody could use them anyway. I think in my platoon we had 6 operating night vision systems, something like that, by the end of the war.
So are you basically saying you had to, like, steal cars in order to have vehicles?
We did. We stole vehicles in Baghdad for a while. And, of course, everybody saw the big thing on the news a while back, a year or two ago, whenever they were talking about rummaging through landfills. And we did that. We took steel plates and put them on the side of our Humvees when we did get Humvees. We took old flak vests and cut them up and nailed them onto the sides. We knocked down metal bars and welded them into the back to make machine gun mounts. So we were very self-sufficient. A lot of the stuff we made it up as we went along.
How did it affect your performance, your ability to protect yourself and to protect others, to have to improvise so much of your stuff?
Well, it gives you a bad feeling, like, you know, you're kind of somebody's stepchildren, you know, like nobody really cares about you. As far as affecting our ability, you know, we were all good soldiers and we held our own no matter what. But it does make you feel a little bit better when you know that, you know, what you're going in will actually stop a bullet rather than just, you know, slow it down.
And what about your clothing? You talk about your uniform being ripped beyond repair, walking through streets filled with sewage in shoes with holes in them.
Yeah, we had we got 4 uniforms total in the beginning, and they just were torn up by the end. And we didn't get any replacements, couldn't get any replacements, and the boots were torn up just from walking so much. I mean, we do 3 patrols a day in Baghdad, and each patrol was, you know, I think had to be 2 hours long or 3 hours long, something like that. So, I mean, you'd walk, you know, easily 5 to 10 miles a day through the city, and it's so hot, you know, the rubber on your soles is starting to melt, and you're just stepping on glass and all sorts of stuff. So it gets torn up. And the streets were full of sewage because the Iraqi toilets weren't made to take toilet paper. And so all of a sudden there's all this toilet paper everywhere going into the sewer system from all the American soldiers there, and it clogged up almost immediately. And then the trash in the street clogs them up because nobody's taking out the trash anymore. And so, I mean, there was always sewage and water in the streets.
There was no way of getting shoes without holes?
You could order them online, but, I mean, you were going to pay for them yourself.
One of the things you had to do was guard duty at gas stations in Baghdad. Why did the gas stations require you to guard them?
Well, I think the gas stations required us to guard them because there was the lines were so long. There were lines just kilometers around the corner, and there were always riots and always problems. When we first got there, that was just what the 101st was doing, and we took over for them. And there was just constant problems there, people getting shot, people stabbing each other and stealing each other's gasoline. So, and, of course, everybody scalping. We didn't speak Arabic. We couldn't read what the gas station sign was. It wasn't for 3 or 4 months that we realized that the people running the gas station were charging way, way more than they were supposed to. And we were just basically there to keep the peace and try to keep things running decent, because as long as everybody had gas in their cars, they were at least a little bit happier. And we had to write the numbers down every day to show how much progress we were making in our sector. That was part of the deal they supposedly made with us, was that as soon as crime went to zero and everything was good in our sector, they would let us go home, which, of course, wasn't exactly true, but we still did our best to make that happen.
God, crime is never zero.
Well, we had it pretty close to zero.
Did you really?
Or at least that's what we thought.
What was your worst encounter with the Iraqi insurgency?
With the Iraqi insurgency? I don't know. I always think about the day that my buddy Wise got killed as probably being the worst encounter.
What happened to him?
They were coming back from a patrol. I was outside actually next to the gate with another friend of mine. And somebody had buried a 155 millimeter round they would bury him in the curb. They would go in at night and they would put in bombs inside the curb and then put like plaster of Paris or something or concrete over the top of it so it just looked like the curb. And then when you went by, somebody, you know, five houses down or whatever would blow it with a garage door opener or a cell phone. And so they blew it and Wise got hit in the head with a piece of shrapnel and he died on the scene. And we immediately, as soon as the explosion, ran outside and had to clean that up. And they were, you know, wounded all over the place. And it was and we waited outside till a medevac came.
What impact did it have on you to see your buddy killed? I mean, does it shake, in addition to like feeling his loss, does it shake your own confidence?
No, I don't think it particularly shook our confidence. Because I don't remember ever waking up in the morning and thinking that today might be the day that I could die or that something bad could happen. There's a constant nagging feeling, you know, that something bad could happen at any moment. But it's never really a sharp fear, and it never really presented itself on my mind too much. I can't speak for everyone else.
You know, you mentioned having to clean up after your friend was killed. And you describe a phone conversation with your wife while you were in Iraq. And you were talking to her, and she was describing what a horrible day she had cleaning up dog poop at home. And then you describe cleaning up your friend's brains. And you write, imagine a war where you can call home after a bad day. How were you able to do that?
Actually, that story was about cleaning up Iraqi brains on that particular day. But I don't know. It's very difficult. It's very hard to compartmentalize, and I'm not quite sure that I was good at it. You know, you like to think you are, and you think you're very, very smooth. But, you know, when you're upset and you're stressed out and you get on the phone and then you try to have a natural, normal conversation, you just have nothing at all in common to talk about. You know, you don't watch the same television shows. You don't listen to even the same kind of music anymore. You have nothing to talk about. Your experiences are so different. And you're on the phone with somebody, and the whole time in the background there's tracers going by and flares going up and explosions, and you're just, you know, carrying on a normal conversation. And it, you know, it's very, very awkward and very difficult. And it, I think it's a problem that we've never really faced, that I don't know if anybody's really faced it in a war, that this constant communication home. You have the ability to – we didn't have the ability during the war to use the phone. But, I mean, by the time, you know, we were an occupying force – you could use the phone whenever you wanted if you wanted to pay for it. You could use the internet whenever you wanted if you wanted to pay for it. So there was just constant communication going back and forth. And instead of worrying about the task at hand and worrying about, you know, patrolling and stuff like that, you're dealing with things that you really shouldn't be dealing with. You're thinking about, you know, what little Tommy did in school yesterday and all that sort of stuff and what's going on at home. And you really shouldn't have that on your mind at all.
John Crawford is the author of the new memoir, The Last True Story I'll Ever Tell, An Accidental Soldier's Account of the War in Iraq. He spoke with Terry Gross in August.